Hello, I'm your reader, Susan Hack, and it's time for our birthdays. Roberto Rodriguez from Ankeny is celebrating today. Happy birthday to you. If today is your birthday and you didn't hear your name, give us a call so we can be sure to get your birthday on our list. Our number is toll-free 877-404-4747. Let's get back to the news now with our first story from USA Today. A Tale of Two Mayors, a month after Floyd's death. Leaders in Minneapolis and St. Paul tackle change, by Jenny Berg. It's been a month since George Floyd died, since former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin kneeled on his neck as he gasped for air and pleaded for his life, since peaceful protests during daylight dissolved into violence after dark, since Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey decided to let protesters overtake the police department's third precinct. And as Chauvin's home base burned, protesters cheered. It's been about half that time since a veto-proof majority of the Minneapolis City Council committed to the long process of dismantling the police. And as Frey opposed the move, protesters booed. Frey, a liberal former civil rights lawyer, has drawn both criticism and praise from local and national leaders, Republicans and Democrats, for his response to Floyd's death May 25th and its aftermath. President Donald Trump chastised Frey on Twitter as a, quote, very weak radical left mayor, end quote, on May 28th. The next day, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz called the city's response an, quote, abject failure. More recently, advocates shouted, shame, 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 outside Frey's home after he said he was in favor of reforming rather than dismantling the police department. Frey said he believes in, quote, deep structural reform. If you're talking about having a full culture shift in the Minneapolis Police Department, I'm on board. If you're talking about making sure that we aren't criminalizing poverty or addiction and making sure we have a different conceptual approach to how we handle it, I am fully on board, Frey said. But if you're talking about abolishing the police department, no, I am not. Frey's initial response earned praise for its swift passion and empathy. The morning after Floyd's death, Frey condemned the officer's actions. Later that day, with Frey's blessing, Police Chief Madaria Arredondo fired the four officers involved. The following day, Frey called for Chauvin to be charged. I was sitting next to him, and he was crying. It was real. It was not politics. He hurt, said Tyrone Terrell, president of the city's African American Leadership Council. We say it all the time. You can't just be the mayor for white people. You have to be the mayor for all people. Two mayors, one problem. In neighboring St. Paul, the mayor may not need that reminder. In 2018, Melvin Carter became the first black person elected to the role. While Carter has borne less of the national gaze since Floyd's death, he and Frey share similarities. Both mayors are young. Frey is 38, Carter is 41. Both campaigned on police reform after fatal police shootings. Jamar Clark and Justine Damond for Frey, Philando Castile for Carter. Both have had varied success in implementing change since taking office. But as they look to help heal their communities, they are working from different starting points. Frey won a Minneapolis City Council seat in 2013, then was elected mayor after promising to fix the broken relationship between the community and police. He replaced Betsy Hodges, who was criticized after the 2015 killing of Jamar Clark, a 24-year-old black man shot during a scuffle with police, and the 2017 killing of Justine Damond, a 40-year-old white woman shot by police after calling 911 to report a possible rape outside her home. Frey faces an uphill battle in untangling the years of mistrust between the community and police department. But for a roadmap to winning, perhaps Frey need only look across the Mississippi River. An officer's son. In St. Paul, Carter said he didn't know enough about the culture of the police department in Minneapolis to comment on it or to critique how Frey responded. "He's been through a nightmare," Carter said. "I think mayors across our country have found ourselves in the position over the last couple of weeks where the good options and stuff we prefer to do just wasn't accessible to us, wasn't among the possible." Carter said Frey's calls to fire and charge the officers was the right thing to do. "I think that was an important thing to do, and it seems he voices a commitment to fundamentally changing the nature of the Minneapolis Police Department," Carter said. "Clearly, there are individuals who feel like that still doesn't go far enough. I think we'll see. I think time will tell." Carter, meanwhile, already has started implementing what he calls, quote, community-first policing. Carter was born in St. Paul, the son of a now-retired St. Paul police officer and a former school teacher. He, too, ran a campaign on police reform after controversial police shootings. The year before Carter was elected, police from a St. Paul suburb shot and killed Philando Castile, a 32-year-old black man, during a traffic stop. Castile told the officer he had a handgun and a license to carry before the officer fired 7 shots at him. Within Carter's first 100 days in office, he worked with the police department leadership, quote, "to completely rewrite our use of force policy," he said. Changes outlined an officer's duty to de-escalate and duty to intervene. It also differentiated the response for when someone is passively resisting versus being aggressive toward another person or officer. Carter said St. Paul is also one of the first agencies in the country to embed social workers alongside police officers to respond to people in crisis. And last year, the city passed a community-first public safety proposal that focused on youth jobs and neighborhood supports, such as ensuring people who return to the community from incarceration can find stable housing, Carter said. The most controversial element was that it did not focus on adding officers. It did not add a single officer, he said. Some of the elements of Carter's Community First lens are the same changes advocates calling to, quote, defund the police, are demanding. If that's what people are calling for, then it certainly feels like something that we are already doing, Carter said. His death won't be in vain. Transitioning from protests to politics will be the real measure of people's willingness to change, said Jim Scheibel, who was St. Paul mayor from 1990 to 1994 and now teaches at Hamline University in St. Paul. "How do we make real change?" he asked. "We can march every night, but unless we begin to change the systems, we won't make progress." The Reverend James Thomas, president of the St. Paul Black Ministerial Alliance, said leaders need to make the commitment that business can't go on as usual. "We really have to dig in and be tenacious about what we want to see happen, and we've got to vote the people out who don't want to listen," he said. Both Scheibel and Thomas have confidence. Frey and Carter can be those leaders. You kind of have to risk your office if you are going to be a change maker, Thomas said. I've met with Carter. I can tell you this. That's what he says he wants to do. He says he's listening. He says he wants to make change. Frey says he listens. He says he wants to make change. Terrell of the African American Leadership Council said that if Minnesota truly wants to change, now is the time to show it. If Mr. Floyd's death means anything, then show the rest of the U.S. and the world that Minnesota is not going to have it anymore. Then his death won't be in vain, Terrell said. He don't know none of this is going on, Terrell added, speaking of Floyd. He would be shocked. He might have said he'd be okay with it if the world is going to do what it's doing so another black man or woman doesn't have to suffer the way he did. I think he'd say, job well done, George Floyd, job well done. Our next story, Pentagon Weighs Full Confederate Image Ban, by Tom Vandenbroek. The Pentagon is considering a policy banning Confederate imagery across the military, aligning its policy with a growing movement, but edging toward conflict with President Donald Trump, Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy said Thursday. Such a prohibition would follow bans already enacted by the Navy and Marine Corps on the war emblem of Southern states that fought to maintain slavery. Legislation proposed in Congress also would strip the names of Confederate officers from 10 Army posts and buildings. The president has been outspoken against such changes, arguing that the names honor history, not racism. The Army has made its recommendation on Confederate symbolism to Defense Secretary Mark Esper. McCarthy declined to indicate the Army's position, but said Esper is seeking a uniform policy for all the military. The Pentagon's decision to consider changing policy follows nearly 2 months of social upheaval after the death of George Floyd, a black man in Minneapolis who died after a white police officer knelt on his neck for almost 9 minutes. Trump has sought military aid in his efforts to quell domestic protests, calling on the National Guard and threatening to send active duty troops to, quote, dominate the streets. Trump, Esper, and Army General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, came under heavy criticism from former top Defense Department officials, including former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, after Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C. was forcefully cleared of mostly peaceful protesters to allow a photo opportunity. Milley later apologized for his appearance there in military fatigues. And now to a story in the money section of the USA Today. 47.1 million jobless claims in 14 weeks. Aid requests are slowing, yet turmoil may go on, by Charisse Jones. Fewer Americans are seeking unemployment benefits, but the number who need help remains high as the country haltingly reopens its economy amid the coronavirus pandemic. 1.48 million workers filed first-time claims for unemployment insurance last week, the Labor Department said Thursday. The latest round of applications means a staggering 47.1 million Americans have made initial jobless benefits claims in just 14 weeks. While the number of people seeking first-time aid fell below the 1.5 million who filed claims the week before, and marks the 12th weekly drop in a row, the slide is slowing. And last week's tally was greater than the 1.3 million to 1.4 million economists expected. Initial jobless claims are the nation's most reliable gauge of layoffs. And in an investor's note, Oxford Economics said the latest numbers, quote, paint a picture of a job market in turmoil. Initial claims fell only slightly from last week, reminding us that layoffs in some areas remain widespread, End quote. When the economy largely shut down in March to slow the spread of the coronavirus, job cuts were concentrated in the retail, restaurant, and travel industries. Businesses, especially, hard hit when people were instructed to stay home. But job losses have now spread to other sectors, including education, manufacturing, and professional services. The nation experienced an unexpected uptick in jobs when roughly 2.5 million positions were added in May, following the loss of 22 million jobs during the previous 2 months. Still, the weekly numbers of Americans needing aid because they are out of work far exceed the previous record of 695,000 first-time jobless claims made in the fall of 1982, when the nation was in the midst of a deep recession. Economists expect the unemployment rate to stay high, hovering around 10% by the end of the year. And many out-of-work Americans may be about to struggle more, as the extra $600 unemployment insurance payment they receive through the Federal CARES Act is set to expire next month, nearly a week earlier than many expected. If these trends hold steady, 26 million Americans are set to lose benefits by July 26th, costing the economy $15.6 billion in economic stimulus per week, and leaving millions of families at a sudden, severe risk for evictions and hunger, Andrew Stettner, a fellow with the Century Foundation, said in a statement. Our next story, rebounding Dow rallies 300 points. Bank shares lead comeback after sobering news about coronavirus by Jessica Menton. U.S. stocks staged a comeback in the final hour of trading Thursday, propelled by bank shares as investors weighed the prospects for an economic turnaround following a sharp sell-off a day earlier. Stocks came under pressure in early trading following a surge in new coronavirus cases and another wave of job layoffs, but turned higher in the afternoon after the Federal Reserve and other regulators loosened some financial regulations for banks. Financial stocks surged after the Fed and four regulatory agencies announced they were going to change a rule that has limited banks' ability to make investments in such areas as hedge funds. The rule change could free up billions of dollars in capital in the banking industry. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 299.66 points, or 1.2%, to close at 25,745.60 after slumping as much as 236 points following the opening bell. Another bout of volatility continued for a second day after the blue chip average tumbled more than 700 points Wednesday on fears of a slower than expected economic recovery from the pandemic. The Standard & Poor's 500 rose 1.1% to end at 3,083.76, recouping early losses as a rise in shares of financial firms kept declines in check elsewhere. Shares of J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Goldman Sachs rallied at least 3% apiece. Stocks flipped between gains and losses during most of Thursday, as the number of Americans seeking jobless benefits remains high, dimming hopes for a relatively quick economic turnaround from the pandemic. About 1.5 million workers filed first-time claims for unemployment insurance last week, the Labor Department said Thursday, with a staggering 47.1 million Americans making initial jobless benefits claims in just 14 weeks. This marked the 14th consecutive week that filings remained above 1 million. While recent economic indicators, like the May jobs report, stoked optimism for a swift recovery earlier this month, the slow improvement in continuing claims puts a damper on those high hopes, Daniel Zhao, a senior economist at Glassdoor, said in a note. To be sure, there were signs of gradual improvement in the labor market. The total number of Americans receiving benefits, for instance, continued to fall, declining by 767,000 to 19.5 million. The marginal improvement in the labor market is a positive sign we're on the road to recovery, but the increasing claims states where virus cases are up proves there will be bumps along the way. Charlie Ripley, senior investment strategist at Allianz Investment Management, said in a note. The mixed data come amid alarm over a surge in cases of COVID-19. Hospitalizations and caseloads have hit highs in more than a half dozen U.S. states. New cases nationwide are back near their peak level of 2 months ago. The 34,700 COVID-19 cases reported Tuesday returned the U.S. to near its late April peak of 36,400 new cases in 1 day, according to a count kept by Johns Hopkins University. The virus has been blamed for over 120,000 U.S. deaths, the highest toll in the world, and more than 2.3 million confirmed infections nationwide. Despite shedding its gains for June, the S&P 500 index is still on pace for its best quarter since the fourth quarter of 1998. The market has been mostly in rally mode since April, as investors focused on the prospects for an economic turnaround as broad areas of the economy reopened. But the recent surge in new infections has undercut that optimism. Following a strong first phase of recovery, the economy appears to be entering the slower second phase of recovery, Gregory Dako, chief U.S. economist of Oxford Economics, said in a note. Looking ahead, we stress that the foundation to this recovery is an improving health outlook. If that measure continues to deteriorate, confidence will follow suit, he said. Bond yields fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note held at 68%. And in tech, Apple's iOS 14 boasts smart home features. Using HomeKit, multiple devices will be able to work together, by Mark Saltzman. Much of the attention this week after Apple's 2020 Worldwide Developers Conference focused on new iPhone features, from customizable widgets to picture-in-picture video to turning your iPhone into a digital car key. But iOS 14 also will usher in several new smart home updates this fall. As Apple discussed Monday at its first online-only event, iOS 14 will work hand-in-hand with Apple's HomeKit platform and with support for the HomePod smart speaker and Apple TV, offering new ways to incorporate security features within your home. First, a quick primer on HomeKit. Apple's smart home platform makes it easier for communication among multiple devices, even if made by different manufacturers, and lets you manage it all by swiping through an iPhone or iPad app, tapping on your Apple Watch, clicking through Apple TV, or speaking to Siri. Much of the control is tied to an app, aptly called Home. From lighting and locks, to heating and cooling, to cameras and speakers, Apple is looking to take a big bite out of smart home automation and control market. Valued at $76.6 billion in 2018 in the U.S., and expected to rise to $151.4 billion by 2024, according to research firm Markets and Markets. As for what's new, suggested automations was one of the highlighted features at WWDC. When you add a new HomeKit-enabled smart home device, your iOS 14-powered iPhone will propose a few suggestions for optimizing its capabilities. For example, If you add a smart light, such as a Philips Hue bulb, the home app may ask if you'd like to try out scheduling the lights to turn on and off at specific times of the day. Or if you have a smart garage system, such as Chamberlain's MyQ, you can have it open the door as you pull into the driveway. Apple also demonstrated additional support for home security cameras as part of its secure video feature. If you have a HomeKit compatible video doorbell, such as a Netatmo smart video doorbell, you will be able to see who's at the front door on your television screen via Apple TV. And with the facial recognition feature built into Apple Photos, the camera may recognize who's visiting and your HomePod can announce their name. Speaking of cameras, a new HomeKit feature lets you assign activity zones so you can designate the most important areas in a camera's field of view in order to trigger an action, including turning a light on and sending a notification to your iPhone or Apple Watch. For instance, you can set up your front door camera to only send an alert if someone is walking up your driveway, as opposed to people walking down a sidewalk or an animal wandering around. While other smart home platforms from Google and Amazon have similar camera features, Apple says all of the processing done, such as analyzing who's at your front door, is handled locally on the device itself, and with no end-to-end encryption between devices, instead of via the cloud, for added privacy and security. That said, Apple confirmed it has formed a new alliance with competitors in an effort to build a universal smart home standard. Other smart home highlights coming soon? A new visual status at the top of the Home app will give a summary of accessories that may require your attention, such as a firmware update, or it may display important status changes. Apple will also add a new adaptive lighting feature for smart bulbs, such as letting colors automatically change throughout the day to maximize comfort, including the removal of blue light while winding down at night. The home area on your iPhone's control center will also dynamically suggest the most relevant scenes and HomeKit-supported accessories you'll likely want to control, based on the time of day and how often you would normally use them. For instance, as you get ready for bed at 11 p.m., you may see controls for turning off the outside lights, locking the front and back doors, ensuring the garage door is closed, and enabling the home alarm. Now let's turn to the opinion section from the Des Moines Register. Voices of Black Leaders. How we'll push for change. Calling for changes in mindsets, policies to end systemic racism. Longtime civil rights advocates, Black Lives Matter, and thousands of protesters in the Des Moines metro area in recent weeks have pressed for quick action on priorities such as the newly passed City of Des Moines ban on racial profiling and elimination of the state's ban on felon voting. But some changes will take months, if not years. We asked a sampling of Black leaders in the metro area to address this question. What is the biggest change you will pursue in the next year to push Iowa closer to equal justice and opportunity? From Ako Abdul-Samad, State Representative from Des Moines. I will continue to work on and encourage my legislative colleagues on both sides of the aisle to draft and pass legislation that will address the issues of racial profiling and racial inequities. I will also continue to work with our senatorial and congressional representatives to adopt into law federal legislation that would support our state legislation. I will also continue to work with our mayors, law enforcement, and community members in other cities throughout the state to create ordinances that will coincide with our state and federal legislation. It is imperative that the local, state, and federal legislation support one another so that we do not create loopholes that individuals can use to not be held accountable for acts of racial injustice. Racial profiling, accountability, and data collection must be in unison between the federal, state, and local governments to be truly effective. From Betty Andrews, President of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP. As America ponders a recent glimpse in the mirror and being startled by the image of a proverbial knee on the neck of its black citizens, many of us in advocacy are being asked about our wish list for justice. Wouldn't it be great if it were as easy as rattling off a shopping list? As the head of the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP, my cart is filled with a number of disparate areas in the criminal justice system that we have been working to change, like racial profiling, mandatory sentencing, felony voting, and court debt, in addition to our reform efforts in health, education, and economics. This work cannot be done in silos. I applaud the many hands and fists that are now raised to enlist in justice efforts. As a firm believer of building pipelines to support advocacy and the founder of the Iowa Summit on Justice and Disparities, which brings together hundreds each year to learn about criminal justice reform, my hope is that those hands belong to individuals willing to make long-term commitments. This is key because racism is like weeds that must be constantly rooted up and destroyed. Undoing a history of oppression and disparate impact will not be an overnight endeavor. Dismantling systems of supremacy will include those quicker wins that can happen with the stroke of a pen, and those longer-term legislative or movement-based actions. But most importantly, it will include persistent change agents who press, cry out, stand, vote, educate, march, partner, and organize. I'm here for it. From Joshua Barr, Director of Des Moines Civil and Human Rights Commission. Systemic racism is a structure that was intentionally created, and it is going to take intentionality to dismantle it. The Des Moines Civil and Human Rights Commission believes that, while policing of communities is of immediate concern, policing is a symptom of much larger issues. Those issues include, but are not limited to, wealth building in marginalized communities, responses to poverty, and opportunities in employment and housing. These long-term issues will not be resolved overnight, but implementing equitable policies will move the community toward the mission of equal justice and opportunity. Through the Bridging the Gap initiative, the Commission has proposed new policies and practices to move the city forward. For example, last year, the City Council took steps on expanding housing options by voting to make source of income a protected class. The city also passed a policy that prevents employees from inquiring about immigration status unless required by law. During a joint meeting of the City Council and Commission on June 11th, the Commission proposed additional policies: an equitable workforce plan to create a more reflective government workforce, restoration of the Youth Advisory Board to give youth a voice in local government, a housing incentives program for city employees to live in Des Moines, a strengthening of the Human Rights Ordinance to include protections for education, small businesses, and ex-offenders, and a community response team to address civil unrest. The Commission will continue to amplify marginalized voices and use our platform for sustainable changes. Through equitable policy change at the local level, we can disassemble the structure of systemic racism and build a community anchored by empathy and mutual respect for all. From Matthew Bruce, Black Lives Matter organizer. I remember the first day of school at East High after spring break in 2012 when the Trayvon Martin case became national news. All week as I explored New York City, I was haunted by young Trayvon's ghost. I wore a hoodie that week and the first day back at East. For young black people, the hoodie is a symbol of strength and dexterity, a representation of the grit it takes to handle everything the world throws at us. Trayvon was murdered in his hoodie. I perceived the enforcement system as an aid to his murder, the stand your ground law, the lack of urgency by police, the muddying of his character in the investigative process. I watched a young black boy like me be put on trial for his own murder. That day at East, I realized my very being, my skin, my hoodie, my voice, was a weapon in the world I lived in. I mourned the world I thought I'd lived in, where people were free to be who they were, and began to imagine how to bring that world to fruition. I am now acting on that imagination, and so are the people of Des Moines. We must imagine a world where violence, whether by detention or deadly force, is not how we mediate problems in our society. We must imagine beyond police altogether. It means investing in research to make care a priority. It means community safety boards and freedom schools. It means working with allies to keep communities free of the factors that lead to violence and victimization. But first, it means that Black Lives Matter must matter. In Des Moines and across Iowa, we must all stand up against the gross injustices black people face every moment of every day. We must commit ourselves to consistent action. We must become responsible for the experiences of all those we share the world with. From Courtney Caldwell, BLM organizer. Within the next year of advocating for social and racial justice, I am hoping that DSM-BLM grows into one of the largest grassroots community-based organizations in Metro Des Moines, where we are not only serving those in our community, but also actively working on bills in the State House that are conducive for each racial and socioeconomic class. This divide between politicians and the community is detrimental to the work of dismantling an insufficient system. There needs to be a bridge built between the black community in Des Moines and the legislatures that, quote, serve us, because bills for black and brown folk are being written and passed by people who are not black and brown. Increasing programming and support for black immigrants needs to be prioritized because they are such a vulnerable group within the black community. This group goes unnoticed in mainstream media, because black folks are not typically first thought of when the word immigrant comes to mind. It is important to dismantle programs such as DACA and allow citizenship because humans cannot be illegal, especially on stolen land. I also will bring urgency to prioritize dismantling the restrictions on reproductive rights. I believe it is unjust and ineffective to restrict how a woman can handle her body. It is absolutely ludicrous to pass bills about women who have had to fight to survive in their womanhood. Overall, I am advocating for those who are marginalized and have intersectionalities with marginalization in one or a plethora of ways. From Terry Caldwell Johnson, CEO, Oak Ridge Neighborhood, and Chair, the Directors Council. Des Moines and Polk County are ideal places to make a life and raise a family. Not a day goes by that new rankings and accolades are bestowed on our beloved city. But for each day that a new accolade rolls in, persistent racial disparities prevail, challenging us to shift the focus and change the narrative. In my role as chair of the Directors Council, TDC, we commissioned the 2017 One Economy State of Black Polk County report, which revealed a modern-day, quote, tale of two cities, a place where persistent racial disparities prevail on nearly every measure, health, housing, employment, education, and financial inclusion. On June 30th, TDC will unveil One Economy, a Blueprint for Action, which sets out goals and actionable strategies intended to address the racial wealth divide and the inequities that exist for all individuals of African descent. My work in the coming days and years will be laser-focused on building One Economy, because we are only as strong as our weakest link. The growth and vitality of our region is predicated on the premise of economic inclusion and eliminating disparities. One Economy acknowledges our inequities and failings, but tempers them with tremendous hope. I think and believe we can build something better for our Black children and their children's children. One Economy challenges us to reimagine our future and to think about the difference between what has been deemed acceptable versus what is possible. Please join me in building One Economy. From Rob Johnson, President of Iowa Juneteenth and minister at Second Baptist Church in Fort Dodge. Quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." End quote. That is a statement directly from our Declaration of Independence. Unfortunately for African Americans, when you have clear disparities in our legal system, our housing system, and in our educational systems, the pursuit of happiness became a pursuit of survival. Black children in the U.S. are 5 times more likely to be incarcerated than their white counterparts. As for home ownership, Black families are more likely to rent than buy. The huge racial disparity in education access and quality leads to Black students not being exposed to advanced classes at the same rate or even having the resources to be successful in school systems that are not built for them and that seldom have staff who reflect their cultural background. If there was one thing I could fix in America right now, it would be to address the wealth gap, starting with the minimum wage. People should be able to not only survive, but thrive in their pursuit of happiness. According to the Brookings Institution, the white average household wealth of $929,800 is 6.7 times greater than the Black average wealth of $138,100. This disparity stems not from lack of trying, but from the pursuit of happiness for Black people in this country being a pursuit of survival. I am simply saying to the system that the numbers and the facts are all clear. We need people who are willing to not just call out injustices, but actively do their part in correcting the issues. Now a letter from the editor of the Des Moines Register, Carol Hunter. History professor Ibram X. Kendi argues in his powerful book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, that it's not enough to declare, "I'm not racist," while doing nothing to dismantle the racist policies and power structure that define our society. "There is no neutrality in the racism struggle," he writes. "Instead, the path toward a just society requires each of us to be actively anti-racist in how we think and act. The stark brutality of George Floyd's death and the reality of racial disparities that stain American life demand that we individually and collectively commit to being anti-racist." What does that look like when applied to the news staff of the Des Moines Register and our responsibility to provide trustworthy coverage to our community? It means We will listen and learn about the pernicious ways that racism infiltrates daily life in our communities. No journalist can afford the arrogance of a closed mind. We will seek to gain understanding of the communities, individuals, and issues we cover to provide an informed account of activities. And further, we will reflect and encourage understanding of the diverse segments of our community. Both statements are the exact wordings from the principles of ethical conduct that guide all journalists who work for Gannett, the Register's parent company. On Juneteenth, much of the Register staff spent a half day hearing from leaders in Des Moines' Black community and from journalists of color on our own staff and from around the country about how we can cover the Black community better. Speaker after speaker delivered the same message. Spend time with us. Get to know us. Don't just sweep in when tragedy strikes. Cover the stories of achievement and inspiration, too. Building understanding is a process, a career-long quest, not a quick fix. But our staff understands that obligation. We will seek solutions as well as expose problems and wrongdoing in order to effect change for the good in the communities we serve. And we will seek to promote understanding of complex issues. Again, those statements are part of the principles and were echoed by our Juneteenth speakers. We have an obligation to dig deeply into policies that perpetuate inequities in areas such as housing and job opportunities. And we must go beyond documenting what's wrong. We must help show how wrongs can be righted. We need to report on how Iowans can become involved in addressing problems in our communities and on what's working elsewhere that has made a tangible difference in improving lives. We will call out racism when we see it. We will use our opinion pages to decry racist acts and systemic inequalities. We will provide public forums for diverse people and views, another of the principles. We will seek out even more diverse voices for opinion page commentary. And whether through virtual video conferences or post-pandemic town halls, we'll offer ways to bring people together to exchange ideas and build consensus on tackling community problems. We will diversify our staffing to better reflect our community and ensure a wider variety of perspectives as news coverage decisions are made. I want to be transparent about the numbers. We employ 5 journalists of color out of a current headcount of 52, or about 10%. We have 2 Black journalists, 2 Asian Americans, and 1 Arab American. None of them is a manager. We have no Latinos on staff. We fall short of reflecting Iowa's 15% population of racial minorities and Latinos, defined as an ethnicity by the census. And our staff makeup is far short of reflecting the portion of racial minorities and Latinos in Polk County, 23%, or Des Moines, 35%. Clearly, we have work to do to increase numbers and diversify manager ranks. This is a journey. We'll no doubt stumble along the way. I'll count on you to call us out when we do and help us learn from our mistakes. The Register recently asked more than a dozen Black leaders in central Iowa to outline their priorities in the next year for pushing Iowa closer to equal justice and opportunity. Their responses are published here today. They're committed and passionate about forging systemic change. It's important for the Register to offer a forum for their voices and for Iowans to hear their ideas. But the burden to make essential change falls on all of us. We haven't done as well as we should, and we own that. Now, as Register newsroom staffers challenge ourselves to do better, I ask other businesses, nonprofits, governments, and associations across Iowa, how will you be anti-racist? Carol Hunter is the Register's executive editor. Contact her at 515-284-8545 or by email at chunter@registermedia.com. Now from the USA Today's opinion section, a letter from Arnie Duncan, the managing partner at Chicago CRED, which stands for Creating Real Economic Destiny, and from Ray Saldana, president of Communities in Schools. Arnie Duncan is also author of How Schools Work and served as U.S. Secretary of Education. Time to change the public school system. Face the pandemic by reimagining classroom. As an unprecedented academic year grinds to an end, with schools shuttered and millions of children learning remotely, education leaders face the task of preparing for reopening with no end to the pandemic in sight. Back to school will not be back to normal, but neither should it be a return to business as usual. As we embark on our nationwide effort to re-enter school buildings, we must determine not just how far apart desks need to be, whether attendance should be staggered, and how often to sanitize facilities. We must also ask how we can build an education system that gives every child in every community the opportunity to learn and succeed. A system better than the one we left behind before COVID-19 and before George Floyd's horrific death at the hands of Minneapolis police catalyzed protest across the nation against injustice and structural inequality. A moment when we are experiencing a national health emergency and nationwide discontent may seem like the wrong time to propose a bold new direction in American public education. But the coronavirus has changed everything, and the Floyd protests have shown a light on inequity. The only way to adequately respond to both moments is to transform K-12 learning for good. Doing so will require a significant federal investment in education. The costs will certainly be high, but the long-term price of inaction will be even higher. An utter lack of leadership and guidance from Washington on how states and school districts should move forward with the virus continuing to circulate is a hurdle. But local leaders across America have shown boundless creativity in the months since schools started closing their doors. They've done their best to find new ways to educate, feed, and support students and stay connected to families. Now, we must move beyond short-term solutions. Any path forward must address extended learning loss among students caused by necessary spring school closures, what experts are calling the, quote, COVID slide, and avoid it if future rolling shutdowns are necessary. A solid plan for the future must also deal with the ways the coronavirus has exacerbated long-standing educational inequities experienced by many vulnerable children, including poor students and many students of color. There won't be one solution, but rather a combination of approaches. Here are some of the evidence-backed principles around which we can reimagine a more just public education. First, the school calendar is an obsolete notion. Children are now so far behind, likely a third of a year behind in reading and half a year in math, we can't wait for fall to help them catch up. Academic recovery has to start now. Summer programs should be offered for multiple years. With the possibility that the coronavirus will be with us for years to come, school districts should consider a year-round academic calendar. Education can be personalized. Schools will likely not be able to welcome all children back at once, or at all, in the fall. schools need to make an individualized education plan for every student that takes academic and social-emotional needs into account. Students with the highest academic and social needs will need more face-to-face time. Out of necessity, many school districts will limit class size to reduce the risk of infection. That can also help us focus on grouping children in ways that best suit learning styles. Competency matters, not seat time. We need to rethink how we expect kids to learn and how we evaluate them. For example, Cleveland's school district has proposed grouping learners in bands of grades rather than assigning a single grade level. That's how many preschools operate, advancing children when they're ready. Competency-based teaching will be helpful not only to deal with the COVID slide, but also natural differences in learning between children and gaps caused by racial and income disparities. Supporting students' non-academic needs is necessary, not nice to have. The national education nonprofit Communities in Schools estimates that for $5 billion to $7 billion a year, we could invest in individualized case management for every child in Title I school and support their non-academic needs. That's a drop in the bucket compared to what we spend on broken systems like policing. These integrated supports could be coordinated by a staffer from the school district or a local nonprofit. Either way, critical student services, such as physical and mental health, housing, and food, enable kids to learn to their full ability. These services will be even more critical in the coming months, with high unemployment and economic uncertainty. These kinds of system-wide changes will require deep investment in human capital, technology, and infrastructure. Many local budgets have been strained by the coronavirus and the protests, and local and state sales taxes are sure to be down next year. School districts will surely be forced to make steep cuts. Absent a federal stimulus package to make up for the shortfall and fund the additional needs, the effects on local schools will be devastating. Even in a pandemic, our nation's leaders have the chance to improve education for today's children and generations to come. They should seize it. From the sports section, a few quick shorts. The NFL is canceling this year's Pro Football Hall of Fame game in Canton, Ohio. Due to the coronavirus pandemic, the league said Thursday. The preseason opener between Dallas and Pittsburgh was set for August 6th. The Cowboys and Steelers instead will meet in next year's Hall of Fame game. In addition, the enshrinement ceremonies scheduled on August 8th will be postponed to next year. Dave Raymond, who originally portrayed the Philly fanatic after MLB gave a reprieve to mascots, said, "The fur is back on the field." In its draft of the operations manual May 16th, MLB banned mascots from the ballpark, trying to restrict access and limit contact exposure because of the coronavirus outbreak. The final version of the manual this week reversed the policy. Mascots are in play, just not on the field. We'll see what that means for the sausage race in Milwaukee and the dashing presidents in Washington. That's it for our second hour of the Register on IRIS. We're so glad to have you listening. I'm your reader, Susan Hack. Coming up next, obituaries from the Des Moines Register.